Okay, we are in this syllabus thing. We've been studying for a while, obviously, what happened 2,000 years ago outside of Jerusalem in what was called the crucifixion of Christ. We know that there was a young Jewish man from historical records that was given the Roman execution for traitors and for despicable criminals. For some reason, what would look like the most horrible of defeats is a matter of pride to God somehow in the New Testament. This is the boast that somehow something went on there at what looks like an ultimate defeat of God by all the human forces, and the best we could do was kill him when he came to earth. And somehow or another, this instrument of death became an instrument of release somehow. God gets the last laugh in this, in his love for us, to where it's, while we're shaking our fist and we're driving nails, he's sitting there freeing us in this process. Only a God would do that. We don't normally respond that well to acts of violence against our persons. But his love was somehow, is somehow godlike. Let's put it that way. And when we go, and we've been studying the way he understood this cross, the way he looked at it, and the words that when he would describe this in the New Testament, when he would say, here is what happened. You look at this, and what do you see? Here's what you see. Here's what I see, and here's what really happened. I learned a long time ago that, you know, we could come up with our opinions about what happened at the cross. And the phrase for that is pooling our ignorance. Pooling our ignorance. And philosophically, what you want to do when you want to know what's really going on, you turn to someone that's occupying what we call a privileged epistemic position. Somebody that really knows, in other words. Somebody that has inside knowledge, and it's real knowledge. It's not just a guess, or it's not counting noses of theologians. Okay, how many people think this happened? Who's got the most noses and the biggest? Okay, you're right. Not pooling that. But it's a privileged position, somebody with inside information that really knows what's going on. This is why, by the way, we try as hard as we can in the Christian life to trust God more with our lives. You know, when I try to figure out what's going to make Glenn happy, or what's going to make Glenn satisfied, or make Glenn fulfilled, or useful, or authentic, or anything decent, good, my best bet is to turn to somebody that made me and knows the blueprints, know the way the system works, rather than me trying to figure it out, which has proved to be an abysmal failure over five decades. Now, so when we turn and try to find the description here of what God did, he uses a bunch of these words. And we've been looking at these words. We looked at sacrifice. We're on now this word redemption, ransom. And we're trying to study the backdrop so that when that word is used in your New Testament, we have some idea of what you would have understood had you been a Roman or a Jewish person then. We're trying to get inside the skin of the audiences then. So when they would see, they would hear the word redemption or ransom, what did they see or hear? Now, the three words we looked at were back on page, let's see, the overview of the words were on page 5. And we had three words, lutron, which was the word for loosing, or freedom. So there's a freedom motif here. The second word was agorazo, which was a buying word. And the third one was this word that I've forgotten how to pronounce since last Sunday, parapuomai. Okay? And we're going to spend the bulk of the time on lutron, because lutron is the word for freedom, and God has a special interest in freedom. So we started in on the background of the word freedom, and the background of the word freedom is the opposite of freedom, which is slavery in the New Testament. And we looked at Roman slavery a little bit, how we got slaves, things of this type. And we came up to the end of page 8. And the main way that people became slaves in the New Testament were they were war captives. We looked at that, war captives. Some were actually born into the households of slavery. Some people actually became slaves voluntarily, strangely. Okay, we looked at why of that, and we'll look at a lot more of that today. Now, one of the things we have to do today is we have to get through the chart on page 9. So look at page 9, because I'm going to use the word slavery a lot, and you're going to do like I do. is flip into New World slavery. And you're going to think of plantation slavery in the New World and the sugar trade and the cotton trade. And that's not the kind of slavery we're talking about. Nor are we talking about the better slavery in the Old Testament. So even though I can't come up with better words than that, we're going to have to get a clearer notion of what we're talking about and what was at issue in the New Testament. So I've got this chart on page 9. And we're going to look at the issues down the left. And we're going to compare and contrast Old Testament slavery, which we studied last quarter. Roman slavery, which we're going to be talking about in the New Testament. And the New World slavery that most of us would be familiar with from history and things of this type. And see the difference. So the first one was the motive. In the Old Testament, why was there Old Testament Hebrew slavery? And it was a humanitarian. In other words, the institution of Hebrew slavery was to give me a way out when I got in financial trouble. Remember, when I got in trouble, I could go sell myself into their Old Testament slavery for 6 years and then have a guaranteed room and board, and I could gather material. And then when I got sent out at the end of that slavery, I had an extra party thrown in my favor, and the owner, my master, had to give me parts of their crops and flocks. So it was literally a social institution for relief of people that got in trouble, that didn't manage their finances well. Okay? Roman slavery, if we remember, we talked about last week, it was about pride and social status. It was about dressing my servants up in the finest of regalia and letting them go free and parade around the streets to show how much money I had. It was a social pride thing. I didn't maybe use them for anything other than as showpieces. Okay? Some freedoms were done. I would let servants go for free. Just I would manumit them, turn them free, just to show that I didn't need them, that I had so many more. It was a pride thing in that. In the New World, it was almost exclusively economic advantage. You don't have the social pride element associated with that. We're just trying to work these people to get the crops out the door. It's economic advantage exploitation for that reason. Different motive. You've got to understand that because that's going to show up later. Entry. How did you become a slave in the Old Testament? Well, it was mostly voluntary, right? I got in trouble, I looked at my options, and I said, okay, I got to go sell myself somewhere. I got to go become a hired laborer, indentured servant, tenant farmer for 7 years. So it was my choice. You didn't normally capture me. You couldn't capture me in Israelite. That was against God's law to do that involuntarily. In Roman, it was mixed. It was mostly involuntary. The biggest supply before the time of Christ was from the war captives. That was the largest slave supply. After that point, when the empire stopped expanding, then it was internal growth, you know, people born in the household, the vernae we looked at, people that were born in slavery in the households of slaves. Some was voluntary. Remember, if I was a king of a foreign land and it was captured by the Roman Empire and I was kept as the king, I would never be a Roman citizen, ever. I was always a Roman subject. But I could sell myself into Roman slavery, right? And if I did a good job and was a decent administrator, by the time I was 30 or 35, I would be freed. And the act of freeing, the official act of freedom, gave me Roman citizenship. So if I wanted to rise to power, now I could not be a senator if I had been a slave before. And I was a freedman, they call it. But my kids that were born free could become senators. Okay, we'll see that these people, the freed people, still had massive power. Massive power, we'll look at. In the New World, it was all involuntary. The slave trade was, I don't know anybody that, I know one or two cases of missionaries that sold themselves into slavery to work in these environments. But other than that, this was all horrific, exploitative stuff. It was all involuntary, slave trading, slave capture. Fourth issue, treatment. Treatment in the Old Testament was good. You couldn't be bad at all to your slaves. You couldn't brutalize them at all. You had to treat them with the same fairness. They got to celebrate with you. They had to make all the religious trips with you. You know, pretty good treatment. In the Roman world, it was very widely varied. In other words, the treatment was good if you had a good owner and bad if you had a bad owner. Okay. Now, we'll talk about what legal recourses you had if you had a bad owner when we get down to options. But it was all over the map. You could have extremely good treatment or extremely bad treatment. In the New World, it was a narrow variance, depending, again, upon the kindness of the owner. But again, it was a much smaller spread. It was all pretty bad. It's all pretty bad. We don't have a lot of glowing reports about what happened in that environment. Let's put it this way. Living conditions in the Old Testament was the same as the master. You lived with the master. You lived with the master and worked alongside the master. In the Roman world, you had it mixed. The rural slaves had mixed character. You had some chain gangs. You had some chattel slavery, plantation slavery. And then you had some good because they were operating independently. Okay, so out in the farms, in the rural communities, the living conditions were mixed. In the domestic, if you were domestic and you lived with the owner, it was good. You literally lived one or two rooms down from them. A lot of the Roman villas that had slaves were shaped like, you know, squares. You had a forum in the middle, like forum class. We're in the middle of everything here, so to speak. We've got this, and all the rooms were around the edges. And so the masters and the servants and the cooking and all this stuff was around here generally. They were still cooking in the forum too, but not sort of like what John and them do. But you would live in one of these rooms sort of like the master of the house did. And so it was, you had decent living conditions. Of course, in the New World, it was mostly very, very bad. Very, very bad and relatively uniform in that. Legal controls on the master. Okay, so these are laws made by the state to control abuse or how the masters treated their servants. In the Old Testament, of course, you got a flood of these regulations. You can't do this, you can't do this, if you do this. If you knock out a tooth, they go free. This kind of thing. In other words, there's a high element of moral control upon the masters, even though they're temporary in the Old Testament. In the Roman, there are medium controls. If I was a slave owner and my slave got sick, for example, and I abandoned them to die because medical care was so expensive to the extent we had it back then. I mean, that's a separate problem. Most of the people died of disease anyway in the Old Testament. And I left them and they died. I could be prosecuted for homicide in the Roman world. The next column, of course, that would not occur. I could kill my slave in the New World and there would be no homicide charge revved against me. There were legal controls on the master. I had to provide food. Closely related is the legal recourse of slaves. In the Roman world, I could sue my master for not feeding me well. If I did not get basic care in terms of food, I could go to court against my master. Okay? You would not see that in New World slavery, obviously. The Old Testament slavery, I could actually do that. I could go to the elders at the gate and make a complaint, because this was a fellow Israelite. I could go to court against them. Legal recourse of slaves was pretty high in the Roman world. I could, for example, around the time of Paul, if my master got abusive, all I would have to do would be flee to a statue of the reigning emperor, put my hands on the statue and say, "I claim asylum. I now want to transfer ownership of myself on behalf of the God." That was not just a statue in the public markets. If my owner, my master, was stupid enough to have one in the house, right, I could run over to the statue if things got bad, or I could just go over there and just put my hand almost there and look at them. Right, this kind of deal. There's some checks and balances in here. But I could, in that particular case, force a transfer of ownership. I wouldn't get my freedom necessarily, but I could force a transfer of ownership. I could also, you have lots of non-legal, not illegal, but non-formal institutionalized ways of pushing back on the master. For example, I could, if I, for example, faked some type of suicide or faked some type of self mutilation or something like this, or threatened that, when the master would go to sell me, okay, they had to put a plaque on me that said they've attempted self-mutilation. Or they've attempted, if they were runaway, they've attempted to run away, or they've attempted to do such and such, which would lower my market value. See? And so there's a whole rank of things that I could do in terms of pushback to sort of semi-negotiate levels of behavior. Like I said, I could go to the courts and ask about the, and like I say, sue if I wasn't getting adequate food. That didn't occur a lot, but I could nonetheless do that. Yes? Domestic servant. Yeah, now the rural servants, you have a mix there, because you do have the ones that are chained up, you know, plantations, they actually do have recourse, because the two or three cases we have of known cases where people actually use that food suing were from rural slaves. You did have access problems. Like I say, the conditions vary extremely widely between those. So domestics could do it. We know of rules that did it, but we also know of rules that were just, you know, didn't do it because of brutalization and fear and things of that type. But you did have recourse that you did not have at all, even legally, in New World slavery. Legal agent status. In the Old Testament, you were a full legal agent. You could, of course, own property. You know, you could do transactions, things of this type. You were just hired laborer. In the Roman world, it was medium. They could sue. They could be sued. You could sue a slave. The slaves could own slaves themselves. We know of cases where there were three levels of slaves. Because the way the institution worked as a thing of status, see, as a social status thing, then as the reign of, as you would rise to social status within the slave rank, right, then one of the ways you would express the status would be owning your own slaves, et cetera, et cetera. So it perpetuated the institution into the medium, into this lit Roman world. In the New World, you didn't have legal agent status. You were literally property per se, period. Now, let me make one comment. In the Roman world, in Roman slavery, around the time we're talking about, you were both a person and property. So you could be deeded, you could be inherited on the death of an owner. So you would pass ownership like that, but you did have legal recourse and some ethical things we'll talk about in a few minutes. Legal exit, when you get free, the Old Testament was automatic. Remember, at the end of the sixth year, you're supposed to go out free. Also the year of Jubilee. And you could go out early, remember, if you were redeemed by a kinsperson. Remember, if my brother Bill came and bailed me out, I'd be okay. In the Roman world, in domestic slaves, it was almost always the case, domestic and urban slaves specifically, you normally got it by about 30 or 35 years of age, if you were skilled and, you know, this type of thing. Rural slaves, you had less opportunity, but depend upon how well you managed the farm and things of that type. But it was still extremely frequent, except in the case of the lower-end slaves. New World, you virtually never. You almost never got, you know, freed. You were in there generally for life. The range of occupations, the type of work you did. In the Old Testament, it was pretty narrow. You were a domestic. You worked domestic things. You took care of the house. You took care of the flocks. Just because they didn't have a wide range. You may have been a craftsperson, actually. You may have done some level of crafts. But generally, that wasn't in the Old Testament. In the Roman world, it was an exceptionally wide range. Most of the people we deal with right now in the government as civil servants would be slaves of the emperor or the imperial families. So most of the bureaucracy we would deal with, they would be in this category of servants. And your occupation ranges would be everything from the people that repaired the streets to musicians, physicians, philosophers. I mean, we gave the example last week about the professor of literature. You know, we have a document as far away as Egypt during this period where there is a runaway slave, and the lady owner posted a little note that said, "Please help me find my servant, and especially whoever convinced them to run away." She was on her way to a foreign city with money to live there and learn how to play music. It was an educational trip kind of thing to learn to become a musician when they disappear. And the range of positions that they do, everything from butcher and baker and candlestick maker and, you know, everything in the world, most of the physicians, by the way, were slaves because the physicians came from Greece. So most of them were captured. They were still, Greek physicians were still the dominant ones. And almost all the education was done by the slave. In the New Testament, what book do we have a reference to a slave teacher? Galatians, where it says the law was our pedagogue to lead us to Christ. The pedagogue was a servant that was responsible for getting the kids to the school and or teaching them on the way. And so that was a slave position, that, that the education of the kids was entrusted to this servant. And that's the word pedagogy, where we get pedagogy. The legal exit occupation types, very wide. You had a medium range in the New World. Most of the ones we know of are not, you know, they're just crops and things of this type. But in Brazil, there was an exceptionally wide range of occupations carried on there, including physicians and things of this type, but not as extensive as the Roman world. Social status, in the Old Testament, it was okay. It was acceptable. An exceptionally wide range in the case of the Roman. Like I say, they were men and women of power as servants in high places that had significantly more power than freed people or a freeborn. And I got an example I want to read you from one of the lives of the Caesars. Throughout the Roman Empire, slaves staffed the offices of towns and cities. And in Rome itself, they staffed all the ranks of the emperor's bureaucracy. They were the nation's civil service. Those who demonstrated satisfactory ability could expect manumission by the age of 30 to 35. After manumission, they would carry on their duties as freedmen. In other words, when you got freed, you still had sort of a guaranteed job in this world because you had the requisite skill set. Matter of fact, you signed a contract at freedom for X number of years where you were on a retainer, so to speak, consulting retainer with your owner to provide X number of services in return for a fee. Okay. The paths in the imperial administration led right to the very top, to posts that today would be held by department heads, even cabinet ministers. During Emperor Claudius's reign, Pallas, a freedman, that means he was a slave that had been manumitted, served as his secretary of the treasury. And Narcissus, another freedman, as his secretary of the state. Both used their position to line their pockets and became so incredibly rich that, to quote Claudius's ancient biographer, quote, once, when Claudius was grumbling about the shortage of cash in the imperial treasury, someone said, and it was no joke, you'd have plenty of cash if your two freedmen would take you in as partner. Pallas, one of these two, Pallas' brother, was the Felix, who earned everlasting notoriety for throwing St. Paul into prison. See, this was a freak that rose to the rank of procurator out in Asia Minor. He had risen from slavery to the governorship of Judea. Those slaves, as mentioned above, were never used as rowers of galleys in the Roman Navy. Ex-slaves could be in charge of those galleys. They couldn't actually row, but they could be in charge of them. Under Claudius and Nero, there were three instances of them serving as commanders of fleets. Presumably, the duties called for administrative rather than naval expertise. So you can see why somebody perhaps would do the involuntary route if they were going to become so wealthy that they, you know, have power, considerable power and economic power. So there's a very wide range of social status. You don't normally get that kind of story in New World slavery. Okay? So there's a wide range of social status from the very, very low, the people in the mines, the people in urban situations, or excuse me, in rural situations, and then those in Imperial Rome. The economic plight relative to the free poor. Okay, so if I'm just a free poor person, how well would the servants do relative to me? In the Old Testament, would do a little better, generally, because I was being subsidized slightly by my owner, the master, my temporary master. In the Roman, it was better to much better. We have cases of, like I say, people that would sell themselves into Roman slavery to get a stable food supply and medical care and education. Okay, just as that, there were evil owners that would free old slaves so they didn't have to take care of them anymore. Okay, it went both ways. Okay, but in the case of when you were in there, it was better to much better than the plight of the free poor. And in the New World, of course, it was same or worse. Same or worse. And then finally, the social advancement opportunities in the Old Testament were good, of course, because you would just sort of automatically go back to where you were, hopefully out of debt, hopefully with some money, hopefully with being welcomed back to the family, having learned your lesson of fiscal irresponsibility, things of this type. In Roman, your social advancement opportunities were excellent. New Wall, it was poor. You just didn't have a lot of that. We have isolated cases. But one of the interesting things about Roman about the domestic slaves, is the way that they would free slave women so they could marry them, the Roman owners. Because the law did not recognize a marriage between a free person and a servant. In Roman law, and so you couldn't pass on inheritance, and they couldn't share in the benefits and things like that. It was illegal. And so I reflected upon this. I wrote an extremely long piece for the think tank. For those of you that are interested in the question about does the Bible condone slavery, I've got literally 50 pages on the Old and New Testament issues about this, and it goes into much more detail than we're covering here. But one of the things that surfaced from this was the fact that Roman society was treacherous from the start. In other words, if I am wealthy enough to have slaves, my life is not fun out in the public. When I go to the Senate, or I go to the baths, or I go to the marketplace, I am always having to watch my back. The treachery and the intrigue up at that level, when pride and social status is your only thing, approximates something like modern culture of the rich and arrogant. Okay. And when you back up and you look at it and you say, we are humans, there are basic personal needs that everybody's got for companionship, intimacy, closeness, comfort, things of this type. Where do people go to find those in a world where everything outside, where the work and the office is treacherous, and your marriages were political to begin with, so there's perhaps not a lot of that. It's in the people you live with at home. It's the servant kids that are playing ball. It is with the servants that are there that don't have that arrogance, pride, and treachery against you. The personal bonds that we get that developed, at least in the domestic and urban scenes, are amazing. The epitaphs that are put on the gravestones, expensive gravestones of owners over the death of a beloved slave. I mean, it's just touching. And historians will look and say some of that's self-aggrandizing to make the owner look good, you know. And sometimes if there's no reason for that, they already look good. They already look good. And there's a real human element of just people, real people dealing with, you know, at a place where it's safer to be, at home sometimes. And this showed up just immensely here, where literally children would be disowned to adopt a child of a servant in the home to give them the inheritance. This was a frequent occurrence in Imperial Rome. So the point of this chart was, I rushed over this pretty quickly, but I just wanted you to see that Roman slavery has this ambiguous character about it. It could be very bad or very good. It depended a lot upon the master and your orientation and things of that type. Yes, sir?
Lynn, I believe there are still instances in slavery in the New World today, but speaking of pre-Civil War.
Right.
How much slavery existed in the world besides that in the United States?
We have slavery that occurred in Middle Eastern countries, you know, up until the 19th century. There was slavery in England up until the 19th century. So you had a good bit. But then again, once you get over into Middle Eastern slavery and Eastern culture slavery, it doesn't look the same. It's not like New World. It's more like the ancient Near Eastern slavery, which were indentured servants at various levels. It's not harsh like the images we've got. So you do have those economic relationships that do show up throughout history at various levels. You still have indentured servant kinds of relationships today in the world. So you still send
it. It's really more of a comment than a question.
Sir.
I started getting from this picture that slavery over the years has gone downhill.
Right.
That is, things have gotten worse over the years.
Yeah.
The other thing is that the New World slavery column, we could sort of assume, ended 140 years ago or so.
Yeah.
And yet, in today's paper, there's an interesting article indicating that currently in the U.S., somewhere around 50,000 people are being imported into the U.S. every year from Asia, Latin America, and Africa, mostly women and children, into sexual
slavery kinds of things.
That number of 50,000 is comparable to what
the New World figures were.
New World
right,
figures.
Absolutely.
I mean, lest we become complacent and right. think that we're beyond slavery. Not only are we not beyond
slavery, right.
we're going downhill.
Right.
It's not even getting better.
Yeah, the atrocities that are perpetrated in today's... One of the theological trends perspectives that you have to look at, you know, from a biblical standpoint, when you look at the culture, there's a general motif, and you don't know where you find this or not, and you can't overgeneralize this. But toward the end, the good is supposed to get better, and the bad is supposed to get worse. The lines are supposed to get clearer. When you look at Paul's delineation about what's going to happen at the end times, where the love of many will grow cold, where people will be lovers of self and pleasure rather than lovers of God. You know, the lines are supposed to get, so the atrocities are supposed to get clearer, and they stand out in the context where it's illegal to do it, and there is no social encouragement to do it, and it still gets done. Then the real character, the heinous character of it, the despicable character of it becomes that much clearer. And the choices are left, it's harder to do the self-rationalization and justification on an ethical basis. Oh, this is good for them. Absolutely. Absolutely. Good point. Yes? Right. The forced laborers are in one of those multiple categories that we've got of the ancient Near East. It's not slaves. They aren't owned. You don't trade them. You don't sell them. You know, it would be like a required, you know, like when a judge says you got to give X number of hours of days of public service or something for a sentence or something like that. They still had their own lives, their own family, you know, so they would have their own, presumably, servants themselves if they were not in Israelite culture. But, yeah, that's another one of those categories of what they call Karvi, where it's a forced labor type, but it's not a slavery per se. It's where you go in and work one weekend a month, you know, and I have to do this, you know, or whatever, this type of thing. So it's not at the same level of severity as this.
The economic circumstances of today are more inclined each day goes by for people to want to be
right.
an indentured servant.
Right, right.
To sell themselves into full budget.
Right. And it's a good point, and you'd have the same thing in the Roman period, by the way. So you'd have a famine come sweep through, times got hard, guess what? Boom, you get people putting themselves on the block. Absolutely. And you would have cases where... one of the things that was peculiar about... no pun intended, actually, but it was accidental there, was that the Roman slaves had this thing called a peculium. What this was my own private money. And so I could earn money and keep it in my little stash here. And I could invest that jointly with my owner in joint ventures. And I would get the cash flow stream. And as I built this peculium up, okay, I could buy my way out of freedom if I wanted to, at what point I want to. So all of the bankers, by the way, in the Roman world were servants of rich people. And they were wise, they were clever, they were shrewd, and they had their own money and they got wealthy. So almost every banker you would deal with during the Roman imperial period would have been a servant. And the bank would have had their money as well as their owner's money in it. But their money would grow, and then once they became freed people, right, they would do further ventures because now they had a higher legal status. See? And so economic situations, as it would be all through history, ebb and flow would affect whether I would go in or go out of it, depending upon what the risk factor was. What the risk factor was in periods of disease. See, the only medical care I would get would be from physicians that were servants inside somebody's house, generally. Now, the cities back then had public health physicians. A Roman city would actually have doctors on staff, but not for the citizens. Not for the citizens. It's the transients that would come in from where I grew up into your state, okay, bringing all kinds of horrible diseases with me, okay, if I didn't have my shots, okay. I'd come in, and to protect the city from people, the transients like me, they would have this public physician or two. Of course, they also had public philosophers to indoctrinate them and brainwash them and propagandize them to move on. You know, welcome to California. Now, how does the bumper sticker go? Now go home. So there were those elements as well involved in this. So, like I say, the circumstances were relatively complex, but it was so widely variant that when we come to this next one on page 10, we have to ask this question, because this is going to make a huge difference when we get into the various problems that we face that brings us to this topic. If some people sold themselves into slavery for social and financial gains, then what was bad about it? What was bad about it then? And I got a list here of at least 10 things that were obvious from the records as what was bad about it. The first, of course, you had no control over one's fate. The stories of Caprice are astounding. Like I say, some of the stories, even of Urban, I don't want to overly paint this picture about the Urban slaves. The more arrogant and vicious my Roman master, the more capricious they might be toward me. We have records. Now, other Roman elite will complain about these people, you know, about how they treated their servants, but at least it did happen. We have records of people that finely dressed servants that are attending large dinner feasts. If they would cough, in one case, every time they would cough, they would get a beating. If they sneezed, they got a beating. Okay, there is one particularly cruel Roman master that the way he would, back before the laws against homicide, so this is earlier in the B.C., before Christ, would throw his servants to be executed into a pool of lemmings, a pool of eels, be torn apart. Particularly cruel. So we have cases of extreme brutality. They're earlier than, you know, generally earlier than New Testament time, but not exclusively so. We still have this. People are still complaining about servant treatment, you know, till 400 A.D., easily. So it was you never knew. I mean, you could have a fit of rage on the part of an owner and get hit. Now, same applied to kids, of course. But, I mean, but this was a situation that was more predictable, more predominant. It did occur. So no control over your fate. You have no idea. Caprice. Or not only your treatment in the house, but you could be a freed person on a trip. You could be traveling on a trip and be captured by pirates, right? We have cases of people being captured and sold into slavery and freed twice. The same Roman nobles, visiting Britain, captured, sold back into the mainland, tried to prove that they were free to begin with, got their freedom reinstated, boom, captured again by a pirate, sold to a different part of the Mediterranean, and then again established their freedom in that situation. But the process took 15 years. So you just never knew what was going to happen. You know, you had no control. Two, the whole empire was against you. Many institutions were designed to keep you in your place. Granted, there were laws to protect you, but that's as long as you were in your place. As long as you were playing with the program, and everybody was doing what was expected to keep the social engine moving, it protected you. You got your food, you got your medical care, you could change owners, etc. Okay? But it kept you there. You were marked, you had to wear special clothes, so everybody knew. As a matter of fact, there's a debate in one of the ancient authors about whether we should have the servants wear special clothes in the city. Remember, it's a status thing, right? And to show who's free and who's not, right? And they decided against it because the slave population was so high that if management said, if labor ever finds out how many of them there are, we're goners. We're goners. And they said, let's drop the dress code requirement. let's drop the dress code requirement. Right. So, but there were things that you had within the slave ranks that you did have to wear and things of this type. Low-level abuse was common. Not just the high-level, really gross stuff, but low-level abuse was pretty common. It was dehumanizing for many. You were property and your status was dead. Remember, this has been one thing that's been common across, not Hebrew slavery, but in most slave societies, Greek, Roman, and New World, you have no life. You are dead legally. You have no kinfolk. So families don't exist for dead people. And so there are no inheritance. There are no homesteads. There are none of this. And so it could be very dehumanizing. What would be? And this is the flip side of the dehumanizing of the Roman elite in their society. And that's part of why the bonds between inside the household were sometimes warm from both sides, because it was warmer at home than it was out in the real world. Five, you participated in only a small part of your life's contribution. In other words, you did get paid. You could earn, you know, your money for your little stash here, but it was very small compared to the, you know, the amount that you actually did, the hard work that you did. It would grow over time, but it wasn't anything like a contract laborer would get in today's world. Now, granted, you didn't have to bear your education cost, you know, or some of those other kind of things, but you certainly didn't get the full value of what you did. Six, pressure to conform, even in matters of questionable ethics, was substantial. Standing up for one's belief could sometimes result in death. The cases we have of there were actually laws that had to be enacted in the early New Testament times by the emperors to protect slaves against sexual violence. It was fairly common before that, rape and being forced into, you know, various type of unethical practices, even me being the banker. You know, my owner could put considerable pressure upon me to do illegal things. And we know this occurred. We have one of the more famous stories of ancient history is about the slave person that was particularly deceitful and was put into, had a Christian master, second, third century. Christian master, invested into them and built them up as a banker, their own money, sent them to Rome to open up a branch bank of the bank that they had over in Mesopotamia. They squandered all the fund, embezzled it, got in trouble with all the investors, and fled, got put in prison, and eventually became Pope. So the behavior of, even in some situations, you couldn't predict who was going to be worse, the owner or the servant. And it just varied so much. But the pressure, and in matters of questionable ethics, there were rules that later came about that protected the, when the owner told the servant to lie or cheat on the, do some fraud, and they didn't, okay, then there increasingly were legal protection for the servant over against the master. So these started showing up. Some of them were more sinister and conspiratorial than you think. In other words, as a servant, if I told on a conspiracy on the part of my master to overthrow the reigning emperor, I would get to go free, scot-free. So you can imagine the impact that would have on manumissions and some of the political pressures that would have had. You had very little, your material needs were often met at a subsistence plus level only. You got your food, you could sue for that. You got clothing, medical care, but you never got opulence unless you were in these special categories of imperial families and larger families. Eight, you had very little power to improve your lot within reasonable time frames. If you woke up at 16 in this condition, you had 15 to 20 more years with no change. I mean, even if you were very adventurous with your money and things of this type, you had very little control over that. If you were strong but dumb, okay, you might become a gladiator or a prostitute. Okay, if you were just dumb and without self-discipline, you would go to the farm and there you'd be under confinement. And that would be the classic plantation slavery from New World environments. You were literally chained and you were in fetters and things of this type. Those were for like people that attempted runaways and things of this type. Anybody that was not, that had any skills or promise whatsoever, was educated and put to work on higher paying occupations because it would make more money for me as an owner. So, but a lot of the captives, that's part of why you would have mass suicides when a Roman army would capture a city. They would capture an army. Very frequently, the army of soldiers would just kill themselves on the spot rather than go back to slavery because they knew the only skills they had would put them right in the arena, put them right in the circus fighting animals and being showpieces like that. So they were mass suicides among armies that would be captured on either side. By the way, Romans would do the same thing if they were being captured by, you know, if they were losing a battle to Germanic tribes or somebody of this type, you'd have the same kind of problem. And finally, the tenth is, if your master was cruel and powerful, your situation could be horrific. The stories are really horrible. Some of them are very horrible. It had everything to do with the whim of the owner. In other words, even your legal access, in some cases by particularly good ones, could be blocked. If you worked for a senator, for example, a senator could obstruct justice, could stop you. Okay? Laws or no laws, there are ways to... We know this. This occurs. Yes?
Where were the lawyers in those days?
The lawyers, about two-thirds of them were servants.
Because this is saying up here, if some people sold themselves into slavery, you would think that, you know, he must have been dumb. If he didn't have any protection,
right.
He didn't have any recourse.
Right.
I can see where if they were soldiers and captured, why they were...
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. It was a predictable enough system that if I was a person of ability, and I sold myself into an urban setting, not just Rome, but other urban settings, it was predictable that I would get out at 30 or 35. So not only was there legal recourse that if I knew about it, okay, but there was also general cultural expectation that I could get there from here. Now, I want to take just a minute to start in on this next piece. So, the bottom line on what we studied so far on this was that there's an ambiguous character, hugely ambiguous, about Greco-Roman slavery at this point, and it has everything to do with how horrific your master is. If your master is amazingly beneficent, good, hearted, kind, you grow, they would bond with you, you would be lifelong, you may become part of the family, literally. Okay? If they're not, then you're in a world of hurt. You're in a world of hurt. Now, when we move here to the second half of this page, page 10, I've got a little sideline, parents excursus, on the masters that are described in the New Testament, because this is where we're going. When we talk about the cross freed us, or we were redeemed, or we were ransomed, in this word, lutron, we're going to have specific sets of masters, and we're going to have to ask the question, how good are they? How kind-hearted are they? And that's what this section is, and I'd like to cover one of them before we close today, if at all possible. Maybe two. These are the masters. When you go through the passages in the New Testament, you say, when it describes servant images or slave images, and it describes a master, which that's what this list is here, just one page roughly of list. The first one is sin. And the verses are, we know that the law is spiritual, but I am unspiritual, sold as a slave to sin. In this case, sin is a master, that he might redeem us from every lawless deed. So this is a deed that's against the law, that violates moral propriety, ethics, that's destructive in its nature. And this particular type of sin is the pull and impulse toward evil and selfishness. So in the New Testament, as we saw in the Old Testament, remember as we started seeing how the problem got worse between the Old and the New Testament, we started seeing that it was higher and deeper than we originally thought. This is part of the deeper. The fact that when left to myself completely, I will move to the wrong direction. If all other things being equal, unless I make some conscious choices or set myself up for success and things of this type, there is just this default. You hit the enter key. Boom, and there you are. You hit the enter key. And it's a pull or an impulse toward, and the Jewish rabbis remember call this the yetzer, the evil yetzer, the evil inclination. It's a pull toward evil and selfishness, self-centeredness, to where the most important value in is what it counts for me. See, and that's just where it all sort of starts there, is when I reconstruct the universe with me as God, with me as the definition of deciding what's good, what's right, what makes the most sense, what is loving and what is caring. It's Glenn and circus peanuts. That's the definition of morality. Whatever. Okay, you get the drill. Okay. And so one of these masters is that this is something that you constantly have to deal with, because even if you don't want to be good for good sake or for the right reasons, a lot of times you don't want to do bad because of the consequences. You get in trouble. Remember that old reaping, sowing wild oats and praying for a crop failure. Remember that illustration, right? That's the kind of thing. Sometimes you don't want to do wrong because you don't want to get caught. And you don't want the consequence of it. Not because you want to do what's right. If you could get away with it, you'd go full bore for it, right? Yet still, it's hard to do, even when you don't want to do it. There's this inclination, this pull in that direction. And something's got to give us some kind of freedom from that, because that trips us up more than we would like. You know, that's a bigger problem than we would like that to be, let's put it this way. The second one would be the law. And in this particular case, it's the consequences of law-breaking, not moral codes themselves. We'll talk about that later. But Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, which is a consequence of breaking the law. And then in Galatians, again, in order that he might redeem those that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. By the way, this is an image from that Roman law. Remember, I'm a slave to law, and I would be freed so I could be adopted as sons. See, remember that? And this is one of Paul's allusion to that practice, where I get a freedom so I could be pulled into the family of God and get all the inheritance and live there and just be a real cool place. Okay. In this case, one of the masters are the consequence engine. See, I break the law, and there's a consequence engine that says I'm going to get busted for it. Destruction is going to ripple down through history, my personal history, out into my family, out into my friends, my community, my world, and then come back around and hit me again. I'm going to the spiral thing. And so this is another master that we've got, that when we do slip up, deliberately or non-deliberately, unintentionally, that consequence engine is something to be dealt with, because it's a harsh taskmaster, and it is inexorable and unforgiving in the consequence engine. And I need some freedom from that too. That's a master that orders me around and treats me with firm discipline. So those two are the masters that God is going to sort of deal with at the cross somehow. We'll get into the dynamics of how that works. But you can see right now that the issue here is how good the master, the owner, your benefactor in this particular case, treats you. And in the New Testament, the treatment is not good for the condition that we are in before the cross. There are forces in our lives and in our choices that are against us. That fortunately, like I say, there's good news because of what happened outside of Jerusalem on that cross so long ago. So let's close with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you that you understood the problem, that you occupy that privileged position, that you really understand the depths of our hearts and the way our hearts work and where our minds work and where our lives are and how we interact, and that you saw the need, that you see the need. You see the dynamics that are involved in our lives and the way we bounce around between these various things. And we thank you that your compassion, you broke into history and you did something about this in the person of your Son, and the love of his heart, the love of his work, the finality of him bearing our penalty on the cross and stepping into the stream of our consequences on the cross himself. We just pray that this week that we would think more about this, that we would understand more that you are after our freedom, that you are good-hearted toward us, and that as we look into these things, we might understand better the price that you paid to give us that freedom, and that there is hope for those of us that are bound to addictions, that are bound to bad habit patterns, that are bound to situations that we have created ourselves that are harsh taskmasters. Give us encouragement and give us hope that to seek you out to get that freedom that you bought for us at the cross. Give us a good week. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.